Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, May 8th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Casual Friday, folks. On the program today, Alex Perrine will be joining us to look at the week that was. Then we will be talking to Gene Ross, one of the presidents from the nurse, the National Registered Nurses Union. National Nurses United. Also on the program, comedian Andrew Kindler will be joining us. He's got a new album out today. So break out your turntables, everyone. Also on the program, a decade of job growth evaporates in 60 days. As reported, unemployment nearly at 15%. And today, sponsored by the Democratic failure of oversight, no basis in law or history, Bill Barr wants the court to quash Flynn's multiple guilty pleas. Meanwhile, Americans still worried about the fast restrictions removal. The CDC supposedly is still working on a plan, and Europe faring much better than the United States. Three Democratic senators proposed $2,000 per person per month as Nancy Pelosi rallies support in the House for nobody knows what. In the Senate, Chuck Schumer naps while Republicans plot judicial appointments. And surprise, surprise, Michael Bloomberg baited and now switches. Speaking of switching, Mike Pompeo says, never mind, COVID probably didn't come from a lab. And the two men who killed Amrud Arbery finally charged. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. I am wearing my soft collared shirt so that you know it is a casual Friday. I don't know what I'm going to do about expanding my wardrobe a little bit, but we'll see. I'll work on that. And also maybe get a haircut. It's starting to get warm, and the beard is starting to bother me, and the hair is starting to bother me, and I'm not sure what to do about it, frankly. I may have a solution a little bit later from our sponsor for today. Meanwhile, let's take a look at it. You'll recall, and this is driving me nuts, you'll recall that there has been multitude of instances where the Democrats should have held Bill Barr to account. During, in the run-up to impeachment, they had said, we're going to talk to Bill Barr, and then they just basically blew it off. There has been such radical, it's really no other way to put this, radical neglect. Wanton neglect by Nancy Pelosi in terms of allowing for oversight. Broadly speaking of the Trump administration, but most specifically about Bill Barr's office, people were calling for him to be brought in front of the House during in the wake of what he did with the Stone prosecution. And what he's doing here is completely unprecedented. You have someone who pled guilty to perjury on multiple occasions. Now, the judge in this case does not have to accept the DOJ saying we're going to stop our prosecution after all this, you know, because they're at sentencing. He could just say, you know what? Not accepting that. Sorry. And it's quite possible he won't. If he sat down with any of the judges who have looked at any parts of this case, you'll recall one of the judges involved in this said, like, I'm surprised you're not being charged for treason. So they're seeing this. And just the question is, like, how much political pressure will these judges feel when the entire administration, the Trump administration, is now saying that, like, you know, Flynn is like Nelson Mandela. I'm not kidding. Here is Barr, and we should say, remember, three or four prosecutors quit the DOJ case against Stone when Barr did this. One, I think, quit the entire DOJ. One of the prosecutors working on this case against Flynn quit on news that this was going to happen. These are all resignations and protests. Let's play this clip here from... this is Bill Barr explaining it, what he's doing on CBS. Oh, and make sure that
you know.
Let's do this in like a four frame or something like that, so CBS doesn't ding us. Go ahead.
Exclusive interview this afternoon inside the Department of Justice. The Attorney General said he was obligated to drop the charges against the president's former national security advisor.
Our duty, we think, is to dismiss the case.
It's a stunning turn of events for Flynn, who in December 2017 pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his discussions with the Russian ambassador after the presidential election. Flynn was ultimately fired by the president about 3 weeks into the job, having also lied to the vice president about his contacts with the Russians.
Flynn lied, and it's like they ruined his life. It's very unfair.
But the department's filing says the FBI's interview with Flynn was unjustified and done without any legitimate basis.
A crime cannot be established here. They did not have a basis for a counterintelligence investigation against Flynn at that stage.
Does the fact remain that he lied?
Well, you know, people sometimes plead to things that turn out not to be crimes.
What should Americans take away from your actions in the Flynn case today?
I want to make sure that we restore confidence in the system. There's only one standard of justice.
President Trump, who has long claimed that Flynn was railroaded, called him a hero.
He was an innocent man.
Are you doing the president's bidding?
No, I'm doing the law's bidding.
You know you're going to take a lot of incoming, as they say in the military, for this decision.
I'm prepared for that, but I also think it's sad that nowadays these partisan feelings are so strong that people have lost any sense of justice.
Flynn welcomed the news with a tweet of his grandson and former FBI Director Jim Comey, who started the investigation into the president, voiced his displeasure on Twitter, saying the department had lost its way.
When history looks back on this decision, how do you think it will be written?
Well, history is written by the winner, so it largely depends on who's writing the history.
Pause it. End it. I mean, the idea that this history, just the concept of history being written by the winners is what you say when you are invading another country. Right? I mean, this is just really basically what you say when you're saying... And the law is specific, like if there is one institution in society that is supposed to counteract the idea that might makes right, it is the law. And yet his justification as how people will view this who are not invested in the partisan fight is, well, the fact that we have the power will dictate how people perceive this. It's not the law, which is specifically an institution to deal with the question of does might make right? I mean, this is unbelievable. And here is, this is what is so frustrating about this. because they're going to be bad actors who exist all the time throughout history in every place and everywhere. But the point is that if there is an opposition party, let's say, they should be doing something. Here is Nancy Pelosi's response. Attorney General Barr's politicization of justice knows no bounds. Why does it know no bounds? What could possibly be the bounds? Like maybe the House could impeach him. That's a bound. That's one way to impose a bound. The reason why Bill Barr's politicization of justice knows no bounds is because she is refusing to erect those bounds. It's up to her. There is nobody else who is in a position to bind him to justice. It's just, I don't know what to say. I mean, it's really incredibly frustrating. And we'll talk more about this with Alex Perrine in a moment. Before we do, I want to remind you, the Majority Report is made possible today by Skillshare. And the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majorityreport8, and we'll put this in the YouTube links and the podcast links, right, guys? Are going to get a free premium membership to Skillshare for 2 entire months. As you know, Skillshare, it's an online learning community, offers thousands of classes on literally any topic you can imagine. All the classes are taught by experts in their field. They have classes on drawing. They have classes on painting. They have classes, like I say, on learning the ukulele. They have multiple classes on ukulele, like kids' ukulele songs. I'm sort of stuck in the kids' ukulele song, sadly, but that's the case. I'm not very good at music, but there's video editing, web design. I've taken classes on how to take good photos with my iPhone. It works. I'm better. Almost all the classes are an hour long. Every class is split up into bite-sized lessons. It's easy to fit Skillshare into your week. It's easy to resume if you've been interrupted by your kids. Happens, believe me. It's been great. Miles, you know, doing the bread breaking, classes and getting into some of the, what do you call them? Cooking classes. Everybody can benefit from brushing up on skills that they already have. Maybe you want to enhance the skills you have. Well, actually, so maybe some carpentry stuff I can look at. Hadn't even occurred to me. A membership to Skillshare is less than $10 a month and gives you access to their entire library classes. But the first 500 people who go to skl.sh/majorityreport8 are going to get a free membership for a whole 2 months. It's a free membership for 2 whole months. Check it out. Like I say, links are below here. Do we have Perrine? No?
I believe we do, yes. Okay. But, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, making his way into the Zoom holding area, the who's that? Well, there he is.
I'll rename him.
Alex, can you hear me?
I can hear you, yeah. I think it had my son's name on the meeting ID there because he had used this to call into preschool.
Yes. There you go. How is that going for him, preschool? How does he like to be ID'd, your son?
Son of
writer at large for the New Republic?
The son of staff at New Republic staff writer Alex Perrine, yeah.
And also host of
The Politics of Everything.
Politics of Everything.
Yeah, the New Republic's recently launched podcast.
Alex, it's been a month. Last we spoke, it had probably been about a month in lockdown. Now it's month two. Everybody's looking a little shaggier. Where? Just give me like, and then I want to go into there's is. I don't know. I'm trying to just like there's this sort of quality of like standing in, let's say, I don't know, like I, for some reason in my mind, I picture like a, you know, like a fully grown cornfield and everything has wilted. Like there doesn't seem to be anything that is functioning the way it should be at this point.
Yeah.
And it runs from the malign to the sort of, nearly malign, it seems to me, in terms of like what's happening around us. But give me your let's start at 20,000 feet and then we will get you know, closer into the ugly details.
I feel like, you know, like you said, it's been a month since last time we talked, and if you had told month ago me that basically we would be here a month later with the situation largely unchanged, I would have, I mean, I don't know, I would have like walked into the sea. Like, this whole thing, the further we get from the start of the pandemic, the like less hopeful I am that steps will be taken to actually fix what's going on. Like, it seemed like at the very, very beginning when it was mainly contained in New York, you know, it was mainly in New York and Washington, and Washington was containing it. And you could say to yourself, well, all right, we get a robust testing program. We start doing what some of the other countries that have succeeded at this are doing. And, you know, it'll be a rough few months, but then we'll be on the other side of it. And we just haven't done it. I mean, you know, you read now, New York is announcing they're hiring a couple thousand people to do testing, or to do tracking and tracing. And it's like, that should have been in March. I mean, it really just should have been in March. I don't know why. But it's like we are getting around now in only in certain places to doing the things we knew we had to do at the start of this. And I can explain why at the federal level, sort of years of disinvestment and the intentional destruction of the state allowed this to happen. But I can't explain why it's happening at every level.
It's stunning. And it just sort of feels like almost like we're taking a mulligan. And we're literally going to do it again, except for nothing has changed. Like I'm going up, I hit the ball into the woods, and I've walked, I've gotten the ball, and that's the price of my mulligan. I went and grabbed it, and I'm going to come back and put it down. That's the way that we play.
Yeah.
You know, I don't get to pull a ball out of my bag. And I turn back to you as you're watching me tee off, and I go, and this time I'm going to do the exact same swing.
Yes. Yeah.
And you're just sitting there waiting me to hit it back into the frickin' woods again.
Right.
Like the only thing. And here's the thing when I say like the failure seems to be universal, like, right. The Trump administration has basically decided, all right, we don't have the ability to do any of this. Like, it's quite clear we don't have the ability to do any of this. And so the plan is going to be, we're going to see if anybody notices. You know, like that hundreds of thousands of people die. We're going to see if anybody knows that. Maybe they won't. I mean, like maybe we can blow through this and we can get to herd immunity. Like, I don't even know statistically how we could get to herd immunity by the time, you know, the election.
Right.
And certainly, like, you know, let's put the economics, to, you know, on set, but that's what's motivating them. Right. They just think that, like, if we pretend it's not there, maybe it won't be.
Right.
And people will come and shop. But the Democrats, like, can anybody articulate what the Democratic plan would be for the country to relax restrictions and sort of like live with the virus? Like, I'm not aware of anybody who has even articulated anything remotely like that.
Yeah.
They're just floundering around hoping that if we stay on the sideline, maybe Trump, you know, will be rational, and this is just going to be problematic because it's, not, as opposed to like, they don't feel like they need to do anything. And then you have half the country is just like, hey man, I'm not worried about no flu.
Yeah.
I'm not a girl. I'm not going to wear a mask. I mean, like literally that's the attitude. And, that I was just saying, like, before we got on, like, this is the worst period of it, it feels like, because, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, like, well, maybe maybe if everybody comes out, maybe it will be fine. And in the same way, it's like, you know, like maybe if I jump out this window, there's like a moment where you're like, wait a second, am I flying?
Yeah, right.
No, wait, no, I'm not. But I feel like we're stuck in that moment where it's like, are we flying?
Right.
And it's terrifying.
Yeah. And I don't know. I think that just because no one is either articulating a plan or laying the groundwork to get us through this, it does seem like, I mean, you know, I think in New York, we'll see once we have reliable antibody testing, we'll see. But I think they inadvertently almost did the herd immunity plan, you know, just through sheer lack of preparation. It was spreading here for a while. And I think part of the like hope and a prayer is just that like, well, you know, and Trump's been saying this since the beginning, like maybe the warm weather will just mean it goes away. But that's just, I mean, that is really just preparing for like, that's just putting it off. It seriously is just saying like, we'll just put it off. So I don't know.
But here's the thing. We haven't gone through the herd immunity in New York.
No.
The reality is that the numbers, you know, probably 15-20% max.
Right.
You know, everybody who's getting the people who are getting the antibodies tests tend to be people who are already sort of like out and about. Mm-hmm. So they have been more likely to have already gotten it.
Right. And the people who've been staying home this whole time they're not out getting tested. Exactly.
And, you know, if it's 15-20%, that means you need 5 times more. I mean, to get it. And if it's conceivable that there is some relationship between, I don't know, how easily you get it and how susceptible you are to dying from it. I mean, I guess like I have no idea, but I mean, like the concept of it seems conceivable to me. And so maybe your death rate's not the same, but for another five, to hit another three or four, five, right? I mean, because you can't just land it at 60%.
Right.
Like you're not in charge of that.
Yeah.
You're looking at, you know, 4 times the death that we've had, another 60,000-70,000 people dying.
Yeah.
In New York.
Yeah.
And the problem is that around America, there's no, it's all going up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean that, yeah, exactly.
It's almost like it's February in the rest of the country.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that the, you know, that feeling that like this was a big city problem or this was a New York problem is going to cause a lot of people where it is rising now to believe that they are immune because they take a car to work instead of the subway or whatever. And I do, I mean, I don't know, like I do think like there is actually some hope that maybe weather will slow it down, the spread, but you know, like in places, and I think about a lot of sort of agricultural areas too, because the sort of places where this is going to spread the worst are places where a lot of people have to work in close contact, and then a lot of people go home to large households. And like that describes not just big cities, that describes much of the part of the country that will be forced to work through this regardless.
The big question to me is like, how hard is it or how easy is it to catch when you're outside?
Yeah. Yeah. And right? I mean,
because we've heard stories of like meat processing plants. We've heard stories about like ski resorts, right? Like in lodges and stuff like that. And it always tends to be, you know, like choruses or funerals that take place in a church. You know, the question is like, you know, have we heard like, you know, I don't know, apple pickers or, you know, like, you know, like, I don't know.
I do. I remember I read, and these are all, you know, like, again, the data is so, cause we're, you know, I'm not an epidemiologist or a scientist. And so we're, you know, I'm just like, we're all just reading the same, papers and research. But, you know, there was in China, there was basically almost no documented cases of outdoor spread. I think Japan, you know, nearly all of it was from restaurants and people indoors. And I do think like it's possible. From what my understanding, it seems like it's possible for it to spread outside, but it's just much, much easier when a lot of people are inside for a prolonged period of time.
Right. And then that becomes worrisome. You know, I mean, that might explain on some level, like why you have Boston and New York more problematic than San Francisco and LA.
Yeah, because absolutely.
Of just weather, the implications of weather in February.
Yeah. And then, this drives me crazy too, because now it's getting to be summer, or, you know, the weather's getting nice. It will get nicer. And de Blasio already wants to start closing parks. And my fear is that, like, just because of an unwillingness to listen to public health officials, they're not going to, like, you know, if we want to sort of survive the nice weather here, we're going to need more outside space for people to go, because there won't be inside space for people to go.
Exactly.
Like, people are going to need to go places. Like, you can't, like, it can't just be complete quarantine indefinitely. So, ideally, and, you know, this is what I think Seattle just said, they're going to close a bunch of streets, like, to cars, so that pedestrians can use them.
Well, didn't de Blasio also make that call too?
He's opened a couple streets, not on the same level as Seattle and other European countries have done. But, you know, I think, like, if we want to talk about the recovery of this, assuming that New York is declining in cases and can get it under control, and assuming we want, like, our small businesses to open and our restaurants to open, like, they're going to need to, like, be able to put people outside, because they still won't be able to let people go inside for a while.
Yes. This is the thing too, and this is, like, sort of thematically what seems to be happening. The right is using this to restructure our society. They're doing it by making, you know, like, small businesses, you know, and the ones who got the loans first, for the most part, as far as I can tell, had, like, you know, 300, 400, 200 employees. Hmm. And that's what the small businesses were. And the big businesses, we all know, got huge bailouts, these industries, or they got free money from the Fed. So there's this structural change that the right is imposing on the country. Here's de Blasio has the opportunity, like, hey, man, like, do 60% of the city without car traffic. Maybe just trucks only or something.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, when we come back from this, you leave 20% to still pedestrians. Like, you can actually make some structural differences.
And especially, you know, if people, when this, like, the mass transit system is in serious trouble financially, and are people going to be intentionally avoiding it? Like, once people have to start going back to work because they're scared of using it. And if that's the case, like, just through sheer physics, we cannot fit more cars going through bridges and tunnels in and out of Manhattan every day. Like, but we're going to see how they're going to try to make that work, you know?
There just seems to be a tremendous amount of and I still think the problem is that we have a lack of federal leadership.
Yeah.
And it's creating all sorts of, like, confusion as to what people should be doing. You know, it's very, I'm not being apologetic for them, but I would imagine it's difficult. You're the governor of New York, or the governor or the mayor of New York City, when, you know, in the back of your mind that there's this, like, large contingency out in the country that's saying, like, this is overblown. You shouldn't be doing it. You know, we should just all get out there and, you know, bust through it. And then you want to impose certain restrictions that makes it that much harder politically to do so, because there's no air cover essentially coming from the federal government.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the economy, because today we got jobs numbers, or they came out today or yesterday?
And I think they came out today. Yeah.
We're at almost 15% unemployment, 14.7, almost 22 million jobs that have been reported through our unemployment system. I'm convinced it's much higher than that. I mean, our unemployment systems are designed in many of these states to sort of undercount and keep people off the rolls. And supposedly, like, 80% of it is temporary unemployment, but that's absurd to me.
Right.
I don't know what that means. The Republicans are talking about, like, we're done, more or less.
Yeah.
And everything's good. And that's because the stock market is up. It's, you know, I think it went up yesterday. I have no idea. I mean, it's, like, doing fine. Pelosi is going around, my understanding is, to try and like get people to support her bill, but nobody knows what's in it.
Right.
And they're getting mixed messages as about, well, you know, how it's going to be, you know, what kind of debate is going to be involved. I mean, the, you know, we hear this stuff, Democrats in disarray. The House seems to be in disarray to me.
Yeah. I mean, it's the House has not, it's not a functional legislature anymore. It's not, it's, you know, it's one person who is, I guess, in direct negotiations with the government and shutting out literally, as far as I can tell, shutting out literally everyone else. And I literally everyone else is sitting home. Like, I don't know what they're doing. I mean, like they're not like, I'm sort of shocked that we're not actually hearing more. I mean, we heard stories that they were alarmed when they thought they might have to go back to Washington. That was when right. They went to the press and said, we're scared. We don't want to go back to Washington. That was the only time I've seen even any of these, like, you know, inside sources say lawmakers are upset about blah, blah, blah. So I don't know. I'm not seeing any dissent.
David Dayan has a piece where he takes the Progressive Caucus to task. there's the cat, of course, yep. The classic cat interruption that we need to include in all our shows now.
I read his piece. Yeah.
Dan's basically arguing, right, that the reason why the Progressive Caucus has been so feckless is because all they're doing is basically, you know, they're putting up a wish list. Nancy Pelosi pats them on the head, says, good for you. These are all great ideas. Really appreciate the effort, what you guys are doing. You guys are doing great work.
Yeah.
And then walks away, and that's it. And they don't go after Nancy Pelosi. They don't try and flex any muscle. I don't know if it's because they don't have any other alternative as to who should be Speaker of the House. I don't know, understand that. I don't know if it's because they don't have the ability to raise money like, you know, Hoyer or Pelosi can, and they feel that they can. I don't know what it is, but what they're doing is not working.
Yeah. I think it's a fear of losing. I think it's a fear of picking a fight and then losing, because when you pick a fight and lose, you reveal that you were weak the whole time. I think that's really it.
Well, here's the thing. It still appears that they're weak.
Yeah, it certainly does. Yes.
And I certainly agree with the idea of, you know, you need to have proper timing. You don't want to get into a fight that you think you're going to lose. That I can appreciate that. But to basically, you know, not even, okay, so don't make it a fight, but let's see, here's some more criticism.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it can't get that much worse than what we have here in terms of what we're doing. And the strategy seems to be like, you know, Trump's just going to drive himself into a ditch, and all well and good. But, you know, like Chris Coons is out there talking about austerity already.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people have to remember, as far as I know, the most prominent surrogate, was that clip from 10 years ago, that Chris Coons clip?
Yeah, I was pretty disappointed in Jessica Raine's social team for that misleading tweet, actually. I checked it out yesterday. That's from a clip with Judy Woodruff from TARP.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, no, it's really deceptive.
Wow, that wouldn't surprise me, though.
I'm sure he will, yeah.
But...
Well, there, you know, there's still, I think you can see there's still a belief that, you know, in attaching time limits and caps on things like the unemployment benefit, which is one of the best things that they've done, but like the fact that there's a cap on it instead of like just saying this is indefinite until the crisis is gone, like that shows an austerian fear of being punished for going too far that I think still has a stranglehold over their thinking.
Well, look, Nancy Pelosi is a Pete Peterson acolyte.
Yeah, absolutely.
She was pushing PAYGO.
Yeah,
like, you know, this is a real problem. And I mean, I also think that we're at the point like where she has missed her leverage point, and I can't tell if that's on purpose or what.
Yeah,
like if
right, I think it like. I do. I really think it was on purpose to the extent that. She knew there was like a time window when anything goes, and very purposefully limited what was put on the table during that time period.
Yes.
And like, maybe she thinks now she can still cut a deal, but in that period when it was like the everything's on fire, anything goes, like that was when she actually worked to make sure only certain options are on the table.
Well, I mean, and it's quite obvious that we are not in the peak leverage moment when everybody in the Senate is just basically like, we're just going about our business to approve conservative justices.
Yeah.
And they don't seem to be like you want, obviously your peak leverage is like when they're rushing to the table to get something out the door.
Yeah.
And you need to say like, that's not what we're putting out the door. And that's why, like, in terms of the way that this, you know, and I hear people saying like, well, if they had said no, then they would be standing in the way of this. You put out a plan from Congress.
Yes.
And you actually make that plan compete with the other plan so that the conversation isn't just that you're obstructing.
Yeah.
But we do know that obstruction apparently does work. I mean, I don't know if people were around the last time.
Right.
But that you're not just obstructing, but you're actually like, they're obstructing your plan.
Right.
Is really what it should be.
Yeah. I don't know. I thought it was very, and I don't even know, like, I can't even really figure out exactly how or why this happened, but I found it really interesting. Again, this was when Congress was still passing its emergency bills, but like right after the last big Senate bill passed, it was like the day after every senator voted for it, Warren came out with her like, and here's what the next round must have. And I was like, why did you wait that extra day? Like, you just voted on a package yesterday and you don't know when the next one will come. So that's the strategy I've seen, not just from Pelosi, but from nearly everyone.
Yeah.
The progressives, the, you know, like from Sanders and Warren to Pelosi and everyone else. Like, they waited there. I don't know.
I think it is what you're talking about is this like intense fear of just like, we're going to wait to have this battle when the stakes are lower.
Yeah.
That's the strategy, right? It's like, you know, these need to get out the door right now. The stakes are really, really high.
Yeah.
And I get the idea that, and this is something that you and I have lived with for now, you know, going into its second decade. I get the idea, the dynamic that Republicans are willing to kill the hostages.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Democrats are not.
Democrats have to be the responsible ones.
But I'm sorry. In this instance, it is not such a clear case of that.
Well, no, the Republicans, the hostage
from a political standpoint. Right. From a political standpoint,
like the Republicans wanted to, and this is what, like, again, what they wanted, they got, which was to stabilize the market. Like the actual real economy, they care much less about, but like returns to investors are doing okay. That's what they wanted. So they got what they wanted. And that was a thing to hold hostage while you saved everyone else.
Exactly.
But instead it was a bipartisan priority to sort of like get that, you know, get that, the markets running again. So.
And it seems to me like with the small business, like the second bite at the PPP, they came back and they're like, we got, you know, 60 billion for hospitals and this and that. And, but my feeling is like, why not go in and ask for more?
Yeah.
Like, they're only giving two, you know, if there's that much pressure to get money out to small businesses, which I think there was.
Yeah.
Then how about doubling that part of it?
Like, especially because,
like, even like get something that is substantial, even to their constituency. Like, if they're coming back and saying we need $250 for small businesses, you come back and you go, you know what? We want $500 for small businesses.
Yeah.
And on top of that, the hospitals and whatnot.
Right. And I mean, this is a time to take advantage of the fact that, you know, Republicans are deficit hypocrites. In other words, like, use that to your advantage. They will spend an unlimited amount of money because they don't care about deficits. But the problem is the other side does actually care about deficits. Oh, my cat's driving me crazy.
she's a huge Pelosi fan.
Yes. No, the cat is going nuts because I'm disrespecting House leadership.
But I'm just really flummoxed by this. I mean, they're going to come out. Hopefully, it'll be a good bill. But there's really, you know, three major things that you need in it. Obviously, more support for people. I would also, you know, health insurance. I just, you know, this idea of COBRA is just absurd to me.
It's, yeah, the fact that they're taking advantage, that they're using this time to literally prop up with huge amounts of money, prop up the employer-based healthcare system is, I mean, it's astounding.
The
it's
most like, expensive part of it, too.
Yeah. Yes, and, exactly.
And they need to have what are known as automatic stabilizers built into the bill so yeah. that these programs that are initiated are contingent not on time periods or fixed amounts of money, but are contingent upon what is happening in the economy as measured by like, unemployment or health insurance or whatever it is, some benchmarks so that yeah. it's automatic. That yeah. this money goes through. And then on top of that, they need to do, I think, fair and safe voting
yeah.
across the country.
Yeah. And I think that the priority is get money to people, figure out how to actually hold safe and free elections. And I think they've been talking about it for the last month too, but like state and local budgets have just had a hole blown in them, every single one. And like that should have been another early priority instead of something to wait to negotiate with later, because they're already imposing austerity, and the austerity that states are going to impose is going to undo any economic stimulus you try to do at the federal level.
Yep. What, how's your feeling about Joe Biden these days? Feeling better? Feeling better?
I mean, I think we talked about this last time, but it's like my fear of him blowing it is being replaced by my fear of him blowing it in November is being replaced by my fear of him blowing it starting in January.
Right.
that's just where I'm at now. I do not have any, I do not have strong predictive feelings about what will happen in the election, but I do have some about what will happen in the event of a Joe Biden administration.
Yeah, I'm equally concerned. I mean, I have to say that I'm still also somewhat concerned about the election. It's the same type of thing of like, you know, they're just sitting back and assuming that like Trump is just going to drive everything yeah. into a ditch. And yeah. the problem is like, he's not doing anything that's rational, at least by any standards that exist around the world. And, that means that he could drive into a ditch, but it also means that he's just swerving madly and that it won't have the impact that, you know, you might not end into a ditch. I mean, it just seems like they're just still on the, you know, do no harm while your opponent is hurting themselves. Don't get in the way type of situation.
Yeah. And like, it's not really clear. I mean, we know this is a sort of disastrous response, but it's not really clear that it's like you can just rely on, I guess, the evening news to communicate to voters that Trump is blowing it. Like that's been the strategy for many, many years, and it doesn't work that way.
Exactly. That is exactly the case. There is no way for the voters. They're looking for cues. They don't know.
Yeah.
I've spoken to multiple top epidemiologists in the country. I've spoke to, economists, and I read this stuff constantly, and I have no idea. I mean, I have a sense of what I should be thinking towards this stuff.
Yeah.
But like, here's the amazing thing about it. They knew the power of having all of these people go and endorse Joe Biden.
Yeah.
You had an electorate that was just like, who's going to win?
How do we decide? Like, tell us what to do. Please tell us which one to pick.
And so they knew that that was the right thing to do in the context of the primary to push people to Biden. But then that like seems to go out the window when it comes to like oversight or when it comes to like, you know, some type of valid criticism. I just read this thing about, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi reacting to Barr on this Flynn thing. Attorney General Barr's politicization of justice knows no bounds. That's because she's the one who's supposed to impose those bounds.
Right.
There's no other mechanism.
Yes. Yeah.
Except for like House oversight at this point. Like there's no, you know, like the sheriff from, you know, Washington County, Washington, D.C. County is not going to come in and go like, you're in trouble here, Bill Barr. I'm the guy who, you know, puts constraints on you.
Right.
No, it's her. It's literally her.
And this is like the oversight stuff is where I feel like everyone who is still defends everything about House leadership has to say, because like we're talking about the most, sorry to use the term, but the most normie Democrats, the ones who are the most sort of partisan and loyal, the ones who like bought the t-shirt of Nancy Pelosi clapping. And like, how do you look at the failure to do any oversight of Barr, like to not even like get him to testify, to just not even try, to give up on it? How do you look at that and then just watch like the Mueller stuff just end with nothing?
It's total kabuki. Yeah. And it's just like saying I can't even come up with an analogy.
But yeah, I mean, they don't want to, right. It's like you said, they knew how to play politics in the terms of winning a primary election. And so they know how politics works. They know how to do it. They just decline to do it in other areas, to just sort of speak clearly and say like,
this is wrong. And here's how we're going to show you how it's wrong. Yeah. We're going to have a hearing about it. Like, yes. We're going to do, like, we can't go and arrest him, but we're going to do what we have the ability to do, rather than just sitting here and fecklessly saying, this guy really seems to be completely out of control and is tearing down the Justice Department. Somebody should do something.
Yes, exactly. Somebody should do something.
Won't please common sense and a sense of dignity take over, please?
Yeah.
Like, it's fucking, it's nuts. It's so enraging. So, all right, Alex, let's wrap this up. Where are we going to be in a month from now?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I mean,
you'll have eaten your cat.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Doesn't this feel like some type of like some quasi like some type of like Hunter S. Thompson like fever dream?
It does. I mean, it really it's surreal. The days bleed together. You tell me we spoke a month ago. I'm like, all right, sure, maybe that was a month ago. Maybe that, you know, like I'm not sure April happened. I'm told it's May now.
Right.
I would like to say is that in places that have broadly more functional local governments, that a month from now, perhaps New York will have sort of a robust testing and tracing operation in place, and we'll have a better ability to track outbreaks, and we'll have it under control. And then I hope that it's not like still then raging through Iowa, you know,
right.
Like, and the sort of small agricultural communities in Texas aren't like dying by the thousands. So that's, I don't know. We'll see.
It's so weird. 'Cause you just have this sort of desire to be like, you know, maybe it will just go away.
Yeah. I right after the schools closed, I just kept being like, you know, maybe in May, like it won't be so bad. In May, they'll reopen. I'll be able to send them back to preschool. And it's like, no.
Right. And then you're like, well, camp could be possible. Yeah,
man, maybe there will be camp. I don't know.
And the problem is that like the function has not changed and the inputs have not changed.
No.
Sitting there hoping that like the outputs will be different.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, Alex Perine, we will see you more or less, probably, hopefully, in a month.
Yeah.
And we'll see. First thing we're going to ask is the proof of life of the cat.
Well, all right. I might have just replaced him with a stray by then. We'll see.
That's fine. I don't know which cat. I, to be honest with you, I didn't get a good enough look at it. So.
All right, good. All right, Sam.
It could be any cat. Alex Preen, everyone, go over and subscribe right now to the Politics of Everything and to the New Republic.
Yeah, please do.
And worth your while, folks, both the print and the digital subscription. Alex, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it, man.
Of course.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Alex Preen. Okay, and next up, do we... okay, I think we have...
yep, on the... now.
What's that? Yeah, sure. Let's bring in Jean Ross. She is the president of National Nurses United. They were protesting... Hold on, we got her here. They were protesting in front of the White House this week because of the lack of PPE. Jean Ross is an acute care nurse, president of the National Nurses United Union, and this is the largest union and professional organization of registered nurses in the country. Jean, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So just tell us about the protests and why.
Well, we thought it was a very good visual, number one, to do it in front of his house so he can see that all of his remarks about us having the equipment we need and everybody getting every test they need are all not true. So we had the first protest with nurses there reading off the names of nurses, fellow nurses who have died. And then the last one... was a showing of 88 pairs of shoes of nurses who have died so that you can clearly see it's getting worse and it's not getting better and we're not going to stop until we get what we need.
And by he, you're talking about the president and his house. That's obviously the White House. So, all right, Gene, give me a sense of like, are you in these hospitals? Can you give us a sense of like just what's happening and where? I imagine the hotspots have been sort of like migrating across the country at different places where there are shortages, or is it just sort of like broadly speaking shortages across the board?
The hotspots will be migrating. It hits us in waves, depending on where you are and where the first person was that was infected. But as far as not having the equipment that we need, that is general. That is all over. And it can be as bad as, okay, this hospital is terribly short, but it can be in the same hospital that one unit has it and another doesn't. There's no plan. There, you know, we have been begging for one since SARS and Ebola. We know what we need. We need the proper protective equipment, which is N95s or better. We recommend better. We need gowns. We need gloves. We need booties. The virus, you know, follows on the soles of your shoes. We have been largely ignored, both before the pandemic and now. We solidly have the support of the public, and we appreciate that, but our job is to protect the public. We cannot do that if we cannot protect ourselves. So people need to understand that despite what the president is saying, despite what the hospital association and employers are saying, we do not have enough equipment and we should not be reusing or decontaminating it.
So where are... give me a sense of... I mean, I know there has been a tremendous amount of consolidation with hospitals and that there's, you know, hedge funds. And I mean, there's every single bit of profit that can be wrung out of these hospitals is being wrung out of them. And often that means that like, hey, are we really going to store up all this equipment? Like how much of this is attributable? Like how much is, we have a failure on a federal level from the national government to procure these things and distribute them in a way that is commensurate with the need. How much of it is that structurally speaking, we were particularly vulnerable to this type of thing because of the consolidation that we're seeing in the hospitals?
Well, it is the system, non-system that we have in this country. You're right. It isn't just this pandemic. We are sitting ducks. It's things nurses have been protesting about for literally decades. The lack of desire to store equipment. They call it just in time. You don't want anything sitting there because, God forbid, that's money. So just in time means you got to wait for your linen. You got to wait for protective equipment. You have to beg. Yes, we do need it. No, I don't need to prove to you that we need it. I'm the nurse. I'm taking care of these patients. I said we need it. We need it. We need enough staffing. Well, it costs money to hire nurses. So most employers, unless they have a union contract, can't be forced to hire more. The system that you hear Cuomo talking about, we should be sharing within an area. Certainly we should be. That is what you would be doing if you had a well-coordinated, true public health care system. Based on profits, what we get is what we've been protesting about for, again, years. It's the closing off of facilities that they decide are not profitable for them, making people go farther and farther out to get their health care. And here we find ourselves in a pandemic. All the things we have been warning about are coming true, and it really doesn't make us feel good to say, I told you so. We right. want it changed.
When we look at the disparities in terms of deaths and in terms of contraction rates too, but in terms of deaths between essentially low-income areas and higher-income areas, between minority communities, white communities. When we talk about closing hospitals that are not profitable, that doesn't mean that they're not getting business. It just means that they're not profitable. And, right? I mean, so, I mean, we're seeing this, we're seeing these fundamental problems with the medical industry play out in terms of these disparities too, aren't we?
We are. You can take a look at the statistics again for many, many years. You don't get the same access to healthcare depending on your color, depending on your income. It's really where your zip code is. You don't get the same treatment when you are in the hospital. You can look at disparities there. It's not just color, it's gender too. Women are discounted more readily than men. These are issues, problems we've had for some time, and it has a great deal to do with the way this non-system is set up in our country.
So, Jean, so what can, you know, where does pressure need to be exerted, right? I mean, Donald Trump does not care what I say. I mean, like he does, he just, he there's no scenario where he cares what I say. Yeah. He cares what you guys say when you protest because nurses are, I think support for nurses and medical personnel is not partisan, and he can lose some of his voters. But from people who are not voters of Donald Trump's, which is I think most of the people we're talking to right now, what can we do to support what you guys are trying to do, just basically help us, essentially? What can we do to do that?
Well, we have a number of ways in which you can help. We have, if you could go to protectnurses.org and sign our petitions there. We have several. One, to get Trump to finally please invoke the Defense Production Act. He should be making equipment right now for the short term and for the long term, because this isn't over. Please fill the voicemail and emails of your legislators. Tell them you believe what nurses are saying. They are not getting the equipment they need, and they need it now. So those are the things they can do. And if you have any questions about how else you can help, you can go to our main website, nationalnursesunited.org, and there are many links to show you the petitions that we have and other ways that you could help.
Jean, lastly, let me ask you this. Like, how receptive are is the Democratic leadership been to, like, any type of proposals that you've given them as to how to push things forward?
Well, there's where more pressure could be applied. They have listened to us. They tell us they have tried to put in place the mandatory DPA for protective equipment. They told us they have put it in every package they've put forward so far. In other words, we need a temporary emergency standard from OSHA, too, to say that if you get if you're in contact with these patients and you're a healthcare worker, you must be provided the equipment that we're talking about. Based on the precautionary principle, more is better. We can always peel off layers.
Of course.
So those are the things that people need to tell the president to do and OSHA to do.
I mean, if I was in the Democratic leadership, what I would be doing is I'd be taking half a dozen of your nurses and I would be traveling around with them constantly and, you know, maybe rotating because obviously they got to get back to work. But I would be talking about, you know, I would just let them tell their stories of how they had a coworker who got sick or how they have to isolate themselves from their family at any given point for weeks, if not months on end because of this. Are they doing any of that?
Not that particular idea you just put out there, but they are, you know, we call them, we talk to them, and the stories that you speak are really gruesome. It's taking such a toll. You talk about the PTSD levels of veterans after they come home from war, you haven't seen anything yet. This is, and you know, of course, about the physician who killed herself. It's hard to describe how awful this is. I know it sounds corny, but what we do is a labor of love, but it gets very difficult when you see that people who should be in charge of protecting you, your employers, your government, are not doing that.
Gene Ross, the National Nurses United Union, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate all that you are doing and all your nurses are doing. And, you know, stay safe and thank you.
Thank you for helping us get the word out.
You're welcome. All right, folks, do we have Dr. Andy Kindler with us yet?
He's not here yet, actually.
I don't blame him. I would hope.
His theme song is, though.
I hope he's smart enough to make me do some other stuff in between there. All right, let's play a little bit of sound as we wait for Andy Kindler. You're out to him, right, Brandon? Like, yep,
he was emailed at the same time as Perrine.
And gotcha. Did he ever respond?
No, neither of them did.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Let's see.
I got you on him, too.
Okay. Andy, it's Sam, and we're waiting for you to hop on the Zoom. There you go. That's the way I text. That's the way I did. That's my boomer text. Here's Donald Trump on Fox and Friends saying that here's the subtext. The subtext is I was asking for my own Roy Cohn. And I was asking for my own Roy Cohn, which Roy Cohn, of course, was a horribly corrupt attorney general. He worked for McCarthy, and then did he go on to be an attorney general? I think he did. Dirty trickster. And I think this is Donald Trump's way of saying, like, I found him. Apparently, it's not that hard.
If Bill Barr was your first attorney general, would there have been a Mueller probe and a Russia hoax?
No, there wouldn't be. He would have stopped it immediately. He saw it immediately. He would have seen it immediately. Jeff Sessions was a disaster. I didn't want to make him attorney general, but he was the first senator to endorse me. So I felt a little bit of an obligation. He came to see me four times, just begging me to be attorney general. He wasn't, you know, to me, equipped to be attorney general, but he just wanted it. He was from a state that I love, Alabama. You know, I won Alabama by a tremendous margin. He wanted it. And I said, all right, Jeff, you know, he was a smaller version of that in Alabama for a little while. He was a very average guy, I find out. But if he goes in, he was so bad in his nomination, proceedings, I should have gotten rid of him there. But every time the word Russia, he knew less about Russia than I did. He knew nothing about Russia. But they got him standing on a line with Kislyak, who's the ambassador. Well, Kislyak had dinner with Nancy Pelosi and Schumer. All these guys, everybody in Washington knew Kislyak. She had dinner with him many, many times. And Jeff, Jeff was just very weak and very sad. And when the name Russia was mentioned, just the word Russia, he immediately, instead of being a man and saying this is a hoax, he recused himself. And he had a deputy named Rod Rosenstein, who probably, I mean, this, you'll see things coming out. But I learned a lot from Richard Nixon. Don't fire people. I learned a lot. I study history. And the firing of everybody, I should have in one way, but I'm glad I didn't, because look at the way it turned out. They're all a bunch of crooks and they got caught. But I learned a lot by watching Richard Nixon. Of course, there was one difference, one big difference. Number one, he may have been guilty. And number two, he had tapes all over the place. I wasn't guilty. I did nothing wrong. And there are no tapes. But I wish there were tapes in my case.
Right.
But learn a lot from Richard Nixon. And you don't do that. The one.
I wish there were tapes, but I mean,
show how much non-corruption is going on around here.
Right. I wish I had taped all the times I was not corrupt. So uncorrupt that if I had tapes, it would prove it. It would be beautiful tapes. Why doesn't he just put a tape recorder in?
It's not the way to start.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like, why didn't you just like start recording yourself? Every day there's going to be sessions. Hey guys, everybody gather around. Let's talk about how much not corruption we're doing.
I'm beginning to think he might have said the thing about Sessions being a dumb Southerner now.
Oh yeah, without a doubt. I mean, he is really, really crapping all over Sessions, and I'm enjoying that. But what's also really clear from this is that this is, they do have a plan. People are saying they don't have a plan for opening up America. They do. It is, we're going to open up the floodgates and we're going to distract people from the tens of thousands of deaths that we're going to possibly have. We're going to do that by making a whole new story about the dirty cops, everybody on the take, Flynn's back, Nelson Mandela, there it is. And I think that's what they're going to do. And then the question is like, is it going to work? Like, they're going to literally just try and push the pandemic deeper into the newspapers and off the newscasts. You're going to be able to watch Fox News in like a week from now, and they're barely going to mention the pandemic. It's all going to be about Flynn and Jeff Sessions and all this other stuff. And if you don't believe me, you can ask Andy Kindler, who is just about to come on after we play this.
Oh, hold on. Give me 1 second here.
I ruined this whole show now. It's unbelievable.
You really did.
Believe it. First of all, I wasn't even look at that.
You don't have a mirror at home? You got to wait till you get on Zoom to fix your hair?
With a Jew like Andy Kindler.
My hair looks so...
You know you can't go wrong. His ancestors wrote the God
of America.
A true Obama bot. Andy believes Obama being wrong. Yeah, Andy Kindler. You made me laugh so hard. I had to write you your own theme song. And it can't lie.
Yeah.
Andy, I don't think I've ever seen, I feel like you're just, I don't know that I've ever seen you this. I mean, you know, we're doing the Zoom thing now. But I feel like you're putting off such positive energy right now that it's almost like I'm a little concerned.
Well, because how old am I again? But I released my first comedy CD today.
Wait, first one?
Well, I had
just the first one during the
pandemic. No, I had a DVD before. I had a DVD. I released a self-released DVD. When I say self-released, you do your own masturbation joke. Hello? What happened? Are my jokes laugh distanced?
Oh, God.
Am I getting some the proper amount of laugh distancing?
I mean, I'm glad we're doing this on Zoom because I wouldn't want us to both catch the giggles virus. As
catch the fire, right? Now, wait a second. Have you ever put out a DVD, but I've never put out a comedy album ever. There's no video, thank God.
And is it literally an album? Like, are you?
Yes, it's available. Well, it's what I call digital vinyl. Okay,
digital vinyl.
Right. You can't get a physical copy because I'll tell you one thing. I don't feel so good, but you know, who does these days? I will never have a physical copy of anything again. I don't want an album. I don't want to collect. I don't want after a show.
I noticed that about the art on your walls. What's going on in your room there?
That's an Andy Kindler painting over there. Can you see that?
But why don't you put up something in your living room?
Because I don't want anybody to be distracted from me.
Can't you put up a picture of yourself? Oh, there you go. All right. There's another.
That's a painting of mine over there.
Really? Are you painting now? Is that you? Did you do that?
Yeah, I did that.
I didn't really look. I had no idea. It looks nice, I think. I mean,
stop it. That's the most disgusting thing I've ever done. Look at my paintings. Also, I made this ashtray. Oh, my God. Now, what were you at? You were asking me something about social distancing or something.
I was asking you about...
looking good.
What's that? You're saying you owned nothing. Everything is digital now.
Yes. Okay. Thank God. That was a great bit. Thanks for reminding me of that hilarious bit.
I want to hear that.
That's right. You are the podcast, which with Josh Elvis Weinstein, that's only available on vinyl.
Only available. That was one of the marketing choices you make that I thought was probably not the best.
Not the best. But here's the thing. I remember now, physical copies. Never again for the rest of my life will I see a sneezy, germ-filled Andy Kindler fan approaching me after the show, sneezing and expelling aerosol into the air with their Bob's Burger article. It's like a stuffed mort that has germs in it, and they want me to sign it. I'm not risking death because somebody wants me to sign their object.
I don't want to. I don't want to bury the lead here. But wait a second. Is there a Mort doll?
No, I don't think so.
I thought I would get that going. I know why Hugo didn't.
Look
get
at you!
Doll.
Unbelievable! Hugo. Listen.
So wait a second. Are you saying that you're never going to tour again? You're never going to go into a comedy club?
Oh no! I'll go into a comedy club, but I will be. There will be a proper distancing. There will be nobody allowed in the green room, including the other comics.
So you're going to announce like germaphobe. That's going to be your hook.
Germaphobe. I'm in the age range where if you watch Murder, She Wrote, they say there's a 20% chance you're going to die. I'm old, Sam. I'm a very, very old man.
Do you set up your computer to do little sound effects when you tell a joke like that?
Ding, ding, ding. It's how I go out to get the mail in the morning.
Oh,
Sam.
My God. Oh, I wish that was – I wish that Afghan was a prop. But it's not.
Excuse me.
It's actually one of your Afghans.
Excuse me. Is my mail in?
I got to tell you, Andy, that I can't imagine a piece of cloth that would offer less protection than that Afghan.
Can you
wear something that's a little bit more dense. Doubling that up is not going to make a difference. You could literally put a huge, like you could run like,
I could spit through
like
it.
like a 2-inch pipe through that.
I'm giddy with the fact that I finally, before I died, put out an album. Thank you. Step aside, Rodney Dangerfield. Back off, Lenny Bruce. Take a hike. Some third person, Bob Newhart, with the button down thing.
Sure. And the phone calls?
Look, how good you look. You look, I know you're younger than me. Would you look like 50 years younger than me?
No.
Oh, my God. Why couldn't I get the good Jewish looks? The handsome Jew. Look at you. You should see my beard when it comes in. It's like
my
Lincoln.
Beard's a little bit spotty.
It looks like Jew Lincoln?
I know.
You know Lincoln?
Yeah, no, I know Lincoln.
analyzing every one of my hilarious moves. And now, if Dennis Miller was on here, would you be analyzing it, or would you be just on the floor?
I would be on the floor analyzing it. What? Let me ask you this. What? When did you start? When did you just decide to do this while you were in lockdown mode?
Oh, no. This is unbelievable. I record this, and all I could think of that was I don't have a good enough scene behind you. You want me to have a horrible library?
Bing.
Hey, it's all coming in. No, I record this in 2012. I have what? Terrible – yes. I have terrible OCD, Sam. And I know that I've mentioned it to you before, but you didn't care about it. And the rest of the people over there
what
are out
to get me. What does the OCD have to do with it?
Because I have had terrible I didn't go into therapy until 4 years, 3.5 years ago, but I had terrible anxiety. I could never complete projects ever, unless it was like Evening at the Improv where you have to go down somewhere. It took me 15 years to put out pilot season, and then it took me – pilot season took
– No, I mean – Get the joke? That's accurate. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah, that's your show.
Yeah. No,
hello?
It
took all right. Time. And then it took me to take out the video. It took me another day. So I've been sitting on this for 7 years because of my OCD problems. And you know what saved me? The quarantine. I couldn't even make a physical copy of it now.
Well, now, so wait a second. So how does, I mean, I don't like, I, when I think of OCD, I just think of like, I got to tap a couple of times before I get the water or, you know, drink my glass of water or something like that. I don't know enough about it. So how does that, how did the OCD prevent you from doing it? Just like you were too nervous that it wasn't good enough, or?
You know what? I like to speak on behalf of all of OCD sufferers when I say that I don't think I've ever spoken to anybody who had more empathy for people who suffer from what we suffer. I think you said something like, being, what is this? You want to tap on a glass of water?
No,
is that one
no,
of those
I
diseases?
I don't mean to do
oh, no, yeah.
I'm curious.
Oh,
I don't know.
I'm sorry.
Right.
Are you having a germ problem? No, usually I'll tell you how it works, Sam. This is absolutely serious for a second, as if I've ever been funny on your show. I thought when I was 20 years old, when I was driving down the street, that I thought, did I just hit? This is not a joke. Did I just hit someone in my car? I heard a thing, like a pebble. Did you hear that, honey? Well, I'm pretending I had a girlfriend back then.
Right,
did,
no,
you,
no,
did you no, hear that, honey?
Embellishing.
Oh, honey, I didn't hear that, Andy. I better run. I better drive around the block and see if I hit somebody. And then you know what I should do? I should call the police later on in the day and say, listen, I don't know if there are people the size of pebbles, but if there are pebble people, has anybody reported that a pebble person was – there was that kind of thing. And it was so debilitating. And in 1978, when I came out to L.A., I went to a free clinic, and I told the therapist there. I said, look, I think when I'm in the car, I've hit something. And she goes, hold on. I'll have to check with a supervisor. They had never heard of anything like that. It wasn't known as much back then that people like – some people think they've mailed someone in an envelope. It's this – thing where you're constantly obsessing.
Wait, some people think that they've mailed somebody in an envelope?
Yes. They think that. That's an extreme version. But the version I have, I don't want to drop names. Ray Romano has the same problem I do. Hello. Everybody loves Raymond.
I think you know him. Also a comedian. I'm not going to say his name. But one of the things I learned, an old friend of mine, and one of the things I learned, you know, a couple of years into knowing him, was that every time he made a charge on his credit card, he would call the credit card company to make sure they got it.
Oh, that.
Right?
Yes. Yes. And he's a scared. Okay. I did the classic Harry Met Sally thing.
I mean, he would freak out if he didn't have the, like, I can't get to a phone.
Right. Yes. And I was told by a friend of mine that there was a guy, he was in a, I didn't want to, I could have name dropped, I could have said it was Michael Sheen who told me that. But that's not the kind of person I am.
Right,
who mentions, no, who told me. Right. That was Michael Sheen. No, but right. He said he worked in the theater with somebody who was late for the entrances in the theater. And years later, he found out, because he wrote a book, his friend wrote, that that's what kept him late on entrances in Shakespeare plays, was his OCD. He couldn't leave the dressing room.
because he was afraid, like he had the wrong costume on or something like that. Yeah. Or like,
what if I had something clearly that I had? Would you have more sympathy then? Why are you trying to figure it out? Like,
I'm not. What? I'm just trying to. Is part of the. Okay, now I can take you seriously. No, you're backlit now.
This is not better, right?
No, you're backlit. That's not. You got the window.
You know what? You dumb do? Idiot.
No. Oh, that's it. You got to go back. Go back the other way.
Go back. Okay.
No, the other side. Yeah. A little bit more. You get the picture. Now we're talking. Boom. Now we have like a real backdrop. You look like.
Well, you know, a Majority Report listener gave me advice last time I was on, which I didn't take. But he said, you have a whole setup over there. You got light coming in from the bottom. You got a guy from the right coming in.
I've got like half a dozen people all stationed around here holding lights for me.
Yeah, you've got Freddie DeCorvida. How much time do I have left, Freddie DeCorvida? You don't even get that reference, do you?
Hey, no, I don't. Was he one of the guys on the Tonight Show or something like that? Or he tell you how many, like five, like something like that?
Sam, I just realized that I could hear you better in my ear if I turned up the volume.
Oh, were you having problems hearing me before?
Yeah, because I didn't want to be hearing you from the laptop, the kids say.
So
the kids
say,
I have an old-style headset.
No, I understand. What, well, I can see it.
Am I that stupid? Okay, I think I might be.
Now, listen. So what else are you doing? So you've just been basically now, and have you been working on the marketing of this? Like it really does appear like you, you're all in. And was it drugs that helped? Are you taking drugs to deal with this, or is it therapy? Or is it
no? I started taking drugs. You see, I have a combination, and this is. I mean, I wouldn't mind getting serious with you right now about mental health, but the thing is that I don't know what's wrong with me. OCD goes along with ADD. So I have actually both of them.
Right.
So the ADD is actually, in my case, related to the OCD, and the OCD is related to the ADD. Like if I'm not thinking while I'm locking the door that I'm locking the door, I'm thinking about nine other things, and I got to remember to go lock the door. So it's like that kind of a thing.
I see. So
and they feed off of each other very in an insidious way. So I didn't get any help. So at age 50, I was put on Adderall, and it saved my life, Adderall, at that time. It saved my life. I would go on the plane, I'd have all these like stomach problems, and I'd be sweating. I mean, I'm not sweating anymore. So that saved my life. And then I used to over-medicate with coffee. I would drink like gallons of coffee every day. So Adderall, for me, was a life-changing event. And I didn't get help for years, so I thought it was a phony disease. So I encourage people to get help.
So you and that made you like focus and remember that, like, yes, I did turn off the iron and I don't need to drive home.
Because I hadn't gotten to therapy yet. So I was not aware that my entire life had been plagued by anxiety. I was anxious not anxious today, but I've had panic attacks in my life.
I mean, you did like text me four times when you were in the queue for the.
I know, it's ridiculous. And yet, because of the ADD, I didn't think of, oh, maybe they sent something to my email, right? You communicated with me by text. So I go, he's going to continue to communicate with me by text. So I will, and first of all, you've never been on time with me.
Oh, I said, I will send a Zoom link at 1:05.
Yeah, but it was in my email.
The email. I didn't say email. You're right.
I should have known.
You're right. You know what? And next time I'll be more sensitive. I didn't know. We should have had this conversation like years ago.
Well, now you know I have a thing.
But I do like this thing. Like, did you send the link to my email? I'll look now. And I'll write, I wrote Brendan did at 1:07. And then you wrote, I'm here at 1:08. And it says the meeting host will let me in. And I was like, okay. So I acknowledged it. I was in the middle of an interview. And
I'm bothering you in the middle of an interview.
The best is, 60 seconds later, it still won't let me join yet.
I was panicked. I was full-on panicked then.
That did feel like panic.
And you know why? Because here's the thing, and if I can help anybody today, I will help you today. I almost have had a breakdown in my life just from your show. I've almost had a breakdown in my life.
How many times?
Never. But No. Not, when I say breakdown, I don't mean a breakdown, but I mean someone will say something about like whatever it was.
You'll get into a thought spiral.
Yes. And so I'll go, oh my God, somebody from the Majority Report doesn't like my statement. Now I have to go back on Twitter and defend my statement. And then boop, boop, da boop, boop. I'm in a rabbit hole.
Right. There you go.
Yeah. Get that. And Twitter is the absolute worst. It's an obsessive compulsive trap because you can check. Because it's fright. A lot of this is fight, flight, or freeze. And so my family has OCD going way, way, way back. My cousin used to call the police station. That's where I got that joke. She used to call the police station to see if anybody had reported someone hitting someone in the car. That's where I got the pebble part of it from the joke.
I mean, back in the day, they used to call the czar to see, like, wait a second, did we get was our shuttle overrun?
Now, don't forget, this has a historical ethnic basis. I mean, when you've been, I would imagine when your people have been, Andy, don't get comfortable. Grab the matzah and we're going. Mm-hmm. Why? I just got comfortable here in Egypt. And now
I've been enjoying, I just got used to being a slave. And now you're telling me we got to go?
How am I going to get through that ocean? Oh my God, the sea is parted. That was my Ten Commandments. It was good?
Yeah, that was pretty good. You did the whole thing. Andy,
we have to go, right?
Well, we have to go in a moment, but not before we do this. Dennis Miller has reborn his career. You know this. Again.
I apologize.
But you apologized to him?
Yeah, because I didn't realize he was onto something.
Oh, hey, there you go. And I don't know if he's still going on Bill O'Reilly's show, but if I'm Bill O'Reilly, I'm a little pissed off because I'm starting to see that, like, it's almost like, I mean, for me, like, you know, you're married, you pass away, you know, you like to think you're in heaven, you want your wife or your spouse or your whatever to move on, right?
Right, right.
But I have a feeling that Bill O'Reilly is not that way. I get the sense that, like, maybe it was the story about how he had people spy on his wife when they were getting divorced. Oh, that was a long time ago, Bill O'Reilly.
But Dennis Miller wasn't involved in that, right?
No, Dennis Miller wasn't. But I'm saying Bill O'Reilly's the type of guy who I think doesn't want other people to move on. But it appears that Dennis Miller has. I think this is the second appearance that he was on Hannity. And the thing that's great about Hannity is that everything Hannity does is to make up for a deficit that he sees in his ratings in some fashion or
excuse. I never thought of it that way.
Like back in the day, he wanted Janine on the program all the time because he thought it would help him with women to be seen, you know, basically attacking. And he had a big problem with women, like his audience, like women really disliked him. They saw him as creepy. And so he would try and soften up. There's that story about, originally, I can't remember what someone just told me this, that Hannity didn't throw, he used to throw like a tennis ball or something like that in in his studio. And Roger Ailes said, dude, you got to butch up a little bit and throw a football. And so,
oh yeah, I have heard that one. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And so, you know, my favorite thing is watching Hannity try and make it seem like he has a sense of humor. And it's really hard to do with Dennis Miller, of course, because, you know, you got someone fake pretending to tell a joke and then someone fake pretending to laugh. But they're both lost.
This is TV magic.
Here we go. Here it is. Dennis Miller's last appearance on Sean Hannity's show.
iTunes, Dennis Miller, sir. How are you?
Johnny, wait 1 second. Something across the wire right now. Sorry, this isn't really a wire. It's a tape measure, but you have a much limited process here as far as props go compared to O'Reilly. But this just coming across the wire.
Yeah, there it is now. Look, he used to come on and he used to say, Billy, remember that?
Bill, wasn't Billo or was it Billo?
No, he was calling him Billy.
Billy. Hey,
and
Billy.
Now he's saying Shawnee.
Oh, my God. This could be a major mistake.
It really hurts. It really hurts. I mean, it hurts me to see, like, how quickly.
Look at him. Look at Hannity. Hannity's like, he's in comedy heaven now.
Right. And he's also really, he's all in on the lapel pin. It's getting,
well, you know, dynamic. He actually shoots steroids in his head. This is a true story.
Hannity or?
Hannity. Moore? Hannity. That's why he has a big blockhead like that. He lifts with his head in the gym and he shoots the steroids into his head.
Bernie Sanders has announced he's running in 2024. So that's pretty exciting. He said that he wants to come back then. He's going to drop out again because he wants to get paid again and he needs a ski chalet and that'll give him property ownership Yahtzee. So Bernie will be back.
You know,
you
got to
beware of the socialist who does the long form taxes. Beware of the socialist doing the long form taxes.
Oh, man. All right. Can hardly wait. All right. So we've been watching Nancy Pelosi. She's holed up in her gated community.
Oh, look at that, mate.
That was, incidentally, that was just all a, that was his set piece joke.
I don't even understand. What's the bit? The bit is that
the bit is
the socialists are.
Sanders is going to run again and drop out again because he wants to make more money.
Oh, how does Dennis, it's unbelievable. This is what makes him such a brilliant referencetician. He really sees, you know what I'm saying? He gets the game, behind the game.
This is what I was going to ask you. It's like, how do you comedians come up with your ideas?
You know what? It's just
how does he come up with that idea? Bernie Sanders is going to run again to make money. It's hilarious. And it's like, where do you get these things?
All I do is watch.
And then everybody has community. To remember, like, first off, there's no grown people
watching this.
First of all, there's nobody watching this who plays Yahtzee.
Oh, you know what? He's been doing Yahtzee. That shows you how a man really is dead inside when he's just going to, he can no longer even come up with a new horrible reference.
We have another example of that with a different comedian after this, but go ahead.
The mansion, some very bizarre footage of her on a comedy show showing off a $24,000 freezer stocked with expensive gourmet ice creams. I'm dying for your thoughts.
Well, I always wonder what's wrong with her. Now I think it might be brain freeze. I think she's eating that. And she never shuts up. It's just occasionally you have to hood her like a falcon so you can get some sleep at night. And Sean, do you want to know the difference between Pelosi and that freezer?
Yeah.
When Pelosi opens her mouth, the light doesn't go on. That's the difference.
Oh.
Oh,
boy. Oh, what a burn.
That, first of all, it's like literally joke book material. Like, and I'm talking like joke books that, you know, that I bought for my son.
You do some sophisticated, you gotta hug the falcon. See, he saw the falcon in the snowman, and that's why he got that reference. You gotta hug the falcon. Yeah, he has like a falcon.
You got to muzzle her because
she's going in for the ice cream. No, she's going in for the ice cream into the freezer.
The funny thing is that Sean Hannity can pretend to have a populist critique of Pelosi that she's showing off a $24,000, refrigerator. Now Hannity, of course, has probably the exact same refrigerator in three different houses.
I don't even see so great about that refrigerator.
But Hannity also has the ability to just like nakedly lie about anything.
Right. Exactly.
So he pretends like it's an outrage that that she has that refrigerator.
Right.
Miller, he's not going to go there with her because he also has that refrigerator or some version of it.
Yeah, how is he going to put that down?
And exactly, like, he's tried to do this. Like, we got to be living in the middle of the country, as I live in Hollywood, Santa Barbara. Malibu.
No, he's in Santa Barbara. He's the richest. He lives in the richest area in the world, maybe.
Yeah, my guess is that he's looking at that refrigerator and going like, either A, I'm going to buy that refrigerator, or B, like, why does she have such a low grade refrigerator?
Yeah, I have, the thing that's amazing though is when you look at that look in his face when they catch just a little bit of Dennis Miller where he doesn't know he's being seen. He looks so evil, almost angry, evil angry, like he's going to turn on Hannity. Even I hope he doesn't.
Yeah, like I'm going to get Yahtzee'd for this. all right, but the Yahtzee thing reminded me of something. Did we take that that tweet? Apparently, Jerry Seinfeld, your best friend.
I heard he has a new, he has the gay French, you finally did the gay French king joke.
Oh my God.
And I'm operating my phone like a gay French king. Why won't they laugh at my gay French king reference?
What gay French king has a cell phone?
No, because like, that's his way of saying.
Pop it up. Hold on. Pop it up. Like he's like really being a, like he just. This is like one of those things where it's like, and where did he do this?
People,
oh, it's his Netflix special. His Netflix special. People are pretty important, you know? Keep going. This is, he's talking about cell phones. Next one. Go ahead.
I'm loading it.
Yeah, I mean, what is he? He's not a miracle man, right? Right, Brendan? Is that Brendan?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Damn right is Brendan.
Brendan.
Please excuse me, Brendan. I'm crazy. I'm
and then
drunk
somebody,
from power.
Somebody else says, "Really? They don't seem very important." And then,
look at that.
I remember when Brendan was like, "Should I get a computer from the year 2003, running Windows XP?"
The way you throw the names on your contact list. Here comes the kicker. Like a gay French king! So here's the thing. Now, you know that is one of the things that I went off on because he said that when he originally did this joke was when Jerry Seinfeld said, comedy, I can't go out into the clubs anymore.
It's dead.
Because and it wasn't even like the bit didn't get a laugh. It just didn't get his usual laugh. So he filled in the blanks. Oh, they must be thinking I'm doing an anti-gay thing. And then, I can't do comedy now. I can't do gay French king jokes. That's it. I'm out. And that's the way he was. He wasn't going to go back to colleges. That's a guy who has to kill so bad that even with $30 billion in the bank.
But it's also what is it an example of is like just total projection.
Uh-huh.
You know, yeah. Maybe his daughter's coming home from college and saying like, Dad, you know, some of the stuff you do is sort of like, in addition, like I don't have the heart to tell you because you're my dad that it's hackneyed. But it's also sort of like, you know, it sort of disregards, you know, people's experience, like a specific types of people's experience. Like you're only talking to like, you know, what you just consider to be normal people, but there's probably a demographic image of what normal people look like to you. You know, she's probably saying this to him and he's like, that's why people won't laugh at my gay king joke.
You know, did you
because
read the
my
article?
Daughter thinks now that she's gone to college, she's like some type of, you know, women's studies major.
Well, now are you referring? He actually did that with his daughter. Do you know this?
There was something like
yes,
that.
Yes, he did that. Yeah, she had come home and said something and had said that she had questioned. He said she had questioned him about the way he was saying something. And he starts going off on, she hasn't even seen Prejudice. She hasn't even seen. If you can dig up the article, it's like it literally, he lives in a tower and he had to throw his daughter under the bus. It was,
well, I think that's what it is. It's just, you know, old guy pissed off that the world is, you know, like he's no longer centered in the universe.
Or this joke isn't that funny. It's just not that funny.
Right, right. He can't see that.
People are gay now. And that this is not, people no longer think of gay people as flamboyant.
Right, exactly. You know, it's not like, you know, when people, and French kings are not at Versailles anymore with the cell phones.
And he's saying gay French king because he knows he can't say, and he's operating his phone like some gay guy.
Right.
Exactly. Right? He's got to say, he can't say, and this is what steams him. If he can't say that gay guys are a little fruity, if he can't do their little fruity bits anymore, I'm not going out to the clubs. No, thank you.
This is a political, where my free speech is being completely disregarded.
When I say to the guy in the front row, two guys sitting together, was this a computer mess up? And they get all upset now because they're from the same sex. I can't make fun now of sex between men?
Have you not noticed how many black comedians I've had in my car for my...
There's not one black comedian who I haven't welcomed into my car.
You know,
I don't really hate him as much as I sound like I do now.
I don't hate him. I just found that attitude. I find that attitude and that thing reminded me. And boy, he really won't let go of that gay king thing. Like, you can't come up with something else.
I can't believe it. But he really did say that. Would that then precipitated a people can't go to colleges and you can't go to college anymore because the kids are so sensitive. And that became a whole thing where the media was doing that. Even, yep. You know, like we were saying, hey, you know, what's that called? It's cancel culture. No, maybe it's they don't enjoy your act. Is what it is.
Yeah, but you have to enjoy my act. Otherwise, I've been canceled by the culture. Andy?
If I can't have a Nazi speak at my college, right? If Richard Spencer can't come to my college, and I'm not going to hear alternative thoughts now? I don't get to hear the Nazi side at my college?
Andy, let me tell you something. This has been... It is so wonderful to see you in such a good mood.
That's true. That is true.
The energy level is fantastic.
Yeah, you can tell I'm a little bit happier.
I can tell that you're happier. I suspect you haven't left your apartment there for weeks or months.
No, I don't have it. I don't have it. You know why I don't have it? I won't allow anyone near enough, even my wife. Before we have sex, I make her take the contact test.
Like a
gay
French king.
And all of a sudden my wife's like a gay French king.
There you go.
The guy at the gay bathhouse is acting like a gay French bathhouse guy. Okay, I'm sorry.
Andy Kindler, the name of the album.
Hence the humor.
It is available
on iTunes, it's available on Spotify. You're looking like you're talking to, you're trying to help an old man with a Toastmasters class. I'm on Instagram now. I'm on Instagram. So you can get it. I think Spotify is also streaming it.
Spotify.
And Apple. Ooh. Apple. What is it? What is an Apple? I don't understand that. It's with the thing that the Beatles started, the record label the Beatles started, where they put James Taylor on Apple Records.
Andy Kindler, always great to have you.
I love you, Sam. I love you. Have a great weekend. Love you, man.
Andy Kindler, ladies and gentlemen. All right, let's go. We got about an hour left. Let's go to the fun half. We'll bring Jamie on. Let's bring her on now so that we can do some plugs. Folks, just a reminder, this program relies on your support. It is the membership that keeps this program alive. Particularly in eras like this that we are in and headed towards, your support makes this show possible. If you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com, please do. And if you are someone who is interested in getting the bonus material every day but don't have the finances, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will hook you up. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Also, AM Quickie, alive and kicking. You can sign up for it at amquickie.com. This week on TMBS, Matt, what happened on the Michael Brooks show?
We had Teray Reed on, who I think I recommended Brendan. He come on and talk about his work. Really great stuff. Check that out, folks.
I've checked it out, and I've locked it down.
There you go.
You can find the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube at youtube.com/TheMichaelBrooksShow. You can find it on Patreon at patreon.com/TMBS. Don't forget to check out Nomiki Khan's show, patreon.com/TheNomikiShow, or Nomiki Khan's on YouTube. You can find that there. And Jamie here with the microphone stand. What's happening, yeah. Jamie?
I'm making this microphone stand work. Blah. So what is happening? What indeed? This week on the Antifada, we had on Assad Hader, who is a extremely smart Marxist. He's such a treasure. He's an editor at Viewpoint Magazine, as well as the author of the book Mistaken Identity, Race and Class in the Age of Trump. And we talked with him about the primary election through the lens of depoliticization, which I think is a very interesting and true intervention that he has come up with to look at what's happening in the world. We talked about, so many things, the dictatorship of the proletariat, state socialism versus anarchist theory, and a little bit of punk rock. Also, the idea of mass politics versus subculture politics, and what's flawed about that framework for looking at socialist politics. So check it out, patreon.com/theantifada. Also, Andy and I moderated a panel. We did this kind of live podcast thing virtually last night for Red May Seattle. Very sad we didn't get to go to Seattle, but we had what I thought was a very interesting conversation with three very smart and interesting people on coronavirus and the future of work. And that is still up for people to watch on YouTube. So I will put a link in the description. Also, Sean and Andy, sorry, one more thing. Sean and Andy are doing a Twitch stream on some barks. I don't know. They don't really tell me what they're doing before they do it. But it's going to be great. And that's right after the majority report today. So assuming they remember that they need to start before the show ends in order to get the raid, everyone on Twitch will be brought there automatically. So twitch.tv/theantifada.
Matt.
Speaking of Twitch, twitch.tv/literary hangover is where I just finished sort of Dark Side of the Moon's plus Alice in Wonderland style. I finished playing Half-Life 2 plus 1984 by George Orwell, and they both concluded at right about the same time. I'm going to be...
What do we read into that?
To which?
The fact that they concluded at the same time.
That they're... I don't know. I they're very thematically linked, and I think it's just we can take it as a coincidence. But I'm going to play some Kingdom Come Deliverance and listen to some Karl Kautsky, I think, on communism in Central Europe this weekend, so, or maybe tonight. So twitch.tv/literary hangover. Go subscribe there.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
We need one extra second here. There we are.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous? You're a little bit upset? You're riled up?
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.